If you please be seated, everyone, and we'll proceed with our first case today, which is case number 63382, the Cadle Company versus Woods and Erickson, LLP. We have Mr. Adams for the appellant, Mr. Miles for the respondent. Mr. Adams, do you wish to proceed? Right. And could you tell me how much time you'd like to reserve? 3 minutes?
Two.
Okay, very well.
Good morning, Justices, Chief Justice. As the court, I'm sure, already knows, this is an appeal dealing with a judgment collection case, dealing with a situation where a creditor, the appellant, had proceeded after, for many years, a judgment debtor who, through a series of trusts, LLCs, and with what we believe the willing and knowing cooperation of his law firm, successfully secreted away millions and millions and millions of dollars of assets, thereby making it impossible for the appellant to collect its judgment. Now, one thing that I found in the answering brief, and I'm not sure the issue is on appeal, is the legal concept of whether you can have a conspiracy to commit a fraudulent transfer. It's the position of the respondent that there is no such thing. It is the position of the appellant, and it is the position of the trial court judge, that one can engage in a conspiracy to commit a fraudulent transfer. In this state, conspiracy is aimed at an unlawful objective, not just a tort.
Wouldn't every lawyer then who does a spendthrift trust for a client be liable then? Wouldn't every lawyer who does a spendthrift trust for a client be liable for conspiracy then?
Well, Justice Cherry, there's nothing wrong with creating a spendthrift trust for the purpose of asset protection. Where the problem comes is when the lawyer and the judgment debtor knows that there is a creditor in active collection efforts. And when one enters into an agreement to try to defeat the collection efforts of that creditor, that's where it becomes problematic. I mean, that's ultimately the definition of a fraudulent transfer, to transfer assets to try to defeat the efforts of the judge.
How could a lawyer ever advise a client who's seeking to avoid collection efforts? I mean, isn't it reasonable, isn't it fair for someone who has a judgment against them to consult with a lawyer to determine how best to protect their assets under those circumstances? Now we're going to make those lawyers liable for civil conspiracy and aiding and abetting in the collection efforts?
Again, there is nothing wrong with drafting an asset protection trust. There's nothing wrong with trying to protect your assets. The problem,
carrying that one step further, suppose in this case all that happened was that Krauss went and consulted with Woods and said, how can I limit my exposure? What can I do to avoid delay or resist the collection of these efforts legally?
Right.
And the lawyer says, well, move this asset over here or put that asset over here. What's wrong with that advice?
I can tell you what the lawyer said in this particular case, because
no,
I think
answer
it directly
my question,
answers your
this,
question.
The extension of this problem, or the extension of any rule you seek here, exposes every lawyer in the state to providing legal advice to creditors and or to debtors subject to judgments.
The lawyer's advice should be, if he's advised, I have a judgment and there is a creditor after me right now, the lawyer's advice should be, let's figure out how we can not engage in a fraudulent transfer to defeat the rights of the creditor. You can still draft asset protection trusts and LLCs. Mr. Woods has testimony in this case where he said, under oath, of course, that he tried to devise a method where He could still transfer the assets but protect the creditor, but he couldn't think of one. Now, when, I mean, in this case, the judge...
I thought the documents were drafted and the transfers made before Woods even knew about the court's order.
Oh, no. No, not at all. Now, then, that was...
You have a record cite as to where Woods acknowledges that he had knowledge of Judge Vega's order prior to the time that the assets were transferred? Because my understanding of the record cite on that point is 20 JA 4981 and 984, where it is indicated the district court found that he did not have knowledge of this order at the time these assets were transferred. Do you have a record cite to the contrary?
I can tell you it's one of them is paragraph 41 of the findings of fact and conclusions of law, which states, even after Woods and Erickson and Krauss had actual knowledge of the debtor exam and document production orders, they continued to act in accordance with the estate plan to transfer assets to remote entities. So, and there was also finding of fact and testimony, but I'll give you the finding of fact. Paragraph 25 of the findings of fact and conclusions of law states that by December 22nd of 2005, Woods and Erickson had actual knowledge of the judgment and the efforts Cadle was undertaking to collect the judgment. And there are several other paragraphs in the findings of fact that so conclude.
To be precise, it appears from the findings that the judge found the estate plan was set up, that
yes,
the entities were created and the advice given before the Woods and Erickson firm knew anything about it, but that some of the transfers postdated knowledge of the judgment collection efforts. Is that correct?
I believe that to be correct.
Okay. I still, though, have the question of, I mean, fraudulent transfer, the word fraudulent, as everyone, I mean, most of the cases say, it's not really fraudulent. It is because you're not gaining anything by virtue of that fraud. It is an avoidance. So it's kind of a misnomer, and the law is full of things like that. But I repeat Justice Hardesty's question to you, which is to say, a client comes into a lawyer and says, I have all these obligations, and creditors are hounding me to death. What can I do? And the lawyer says, well, one option is to transfer your assets to entities. Now, mind you, there's a risk of those transactions being unwound on a fraudulent transfer claim. A lawyer would counsel the client that that's true. Or the lawyer might say, you know, you'd be better off just pulling the plug on the whole thing and filing Chapter 7 or 13 or 11 or whatever it is that works for you. I'm having a lot of trouble saying that is tortious misconduct that entitles the creditor to sue the lawyer for giving that advice.
Yes. I appreciate
I'm struggling
your point
with
of
that.
View.
And the cases seem to say we don't extend conspiracy and aiding and abetting to lawyers in that setting, at least the national law. Nevada hasn't weighed in, and you're writing on a clean slate on that. So could you address that policy question for me anyway?
I can. The policy question that you just addressed has already been addressed by the legislature in, gosh, I can't remember if it was
2009, but it's very limited and it doesn't reach your situation.
Well, it does talk about specific bad faith, clear and convincing evidence standards, those things that were not in play during the course of this particular trial.
That statute, though, postdates your...
The case was filed before the statute was amended.
Yes, and all of everything was a fait accompli.
Right.
And you abandoned whatever claim you were trying to assert under that statute, right?
I believe that's true.
So, okay, tell me about the statute and why it should matter to our court.
I don't think the statute should matter to the court because the version of the statute that is being argued in these proceedings is not the same version of the statute. The earlier version of the statute really made no reference to burdens of proof or anything like that. What concerns me with this case is, and this is a public policy argument, and maybe it no longer matters because of the statute, but lawyers should not knowingly engage in activities that assist their clients in violating the law. And well, I believe that's what happened in this
case. And you're getting into ethical issues on that, too.
That is true.
I think my question, Mr. Adams, is assuming we agree with that concept, the judge had a bench trial. There was extensive findings of fact and conclusions of law. The judge found against Mr. Krause for fraudulent transfers.
Yes.
But the court also found against your claims on the law firm. So because it's a bench trial and we have to give deference to these findings of fact and conclusions of law, unless they're clearly erroneous, how do you overcome that burden in this case to ask us to reverse the judgment against the law firm?
Well, there's really three answers to that question. And the first one, the clearly erroneous standard, I'm afraid I may not have enough time to fully address, because it really involves an examination of the findings of fact and what the law firm knew, when it knew it, what it did. For example, there was a judgment debtor's exam notice issued. In between the notice, the receipt by the law firm, and the actual judgment debtor's exam, the law firm is drafting assignments of assets.
That's in the findings of fact. You had number 41 and all you referred to.
Sure.
So the court was well aware of all of that, but the court concluded that the law firm should still not be held liable for this. So that's my question. You know, the judge heard all the evidence, heard all the facts. We can't find facts here in the Supreme Court. We have to just review the record. So how do we meet that standard there?
Well, it's our belief that the ruling could not both condemn Mr. Krause for committing a fraudulent transfer and not also condemn the law firm for actively helping him do it and actively helping him violate the law when they had full knowledge of the judgment, full knowledge of the collection efforts. They were the collection defense law firm. They were sitting in the judgment debtor's exams listening to Mr. Krause saying, "I'm insolvent. I have no assets." When it was in fact the law firm that, after the notice of the judgment debtor's exam, made that so. So I'd like to try to get on to...
Return to the statute for a moment.
Yes.
Go ahead.
The statute seems to me, it was passed in 2009, you're not relying on it, and it does address the policy question of in what circumstances should a lawyer be held liable or potentially liable to a creditor in analogous situation to what your client is. That statute, though, didn't exist before. I mean, what do we do with that? Do we say that that statute changed the common law and that, therefore, your case is sunk, or do we say it was an articulation of the common law and a recognition that your claim preexisted and just a statutory confirmation? I mean, what's your argument on that point?
I appreciate that question, and that was the very question that was put to the trial court. And after examining the pre-amended statute and the post-amended statute, the trial court determined that it was not a clarification of existing law, but in fact it was a change to the law. And that's what we argued at the trial court level. I'll unless there's any...
Yeah, when you come back, maybe you could amplify that a bit.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
We'll give you 3 minutes in rebuttal because we ate up a lot of your time, and we'll add another minute to Mr. Miles' time, so I have 16 minutes to present his case.
Mm-hmm. Well, good morning to each of you.
Mr. Miles, could I start with a question right off the bat? I'd like you to be able to respond. I've been waiting 7 years to ask this question.
Oh. Yes.
What did Woods know, and when did he know it? It doesn't matter what he knew, and when did he know it?
I think it does matter, because that was part of the basis of Judge Gonzalez's ruling, is that this whole estate plan, these entities that were part of the estate plan, the two trusts that were drafted long before the law firm knew about the judgment, a whole year before, even more than a year before. And so that this estate plan was put in place, as Mr. Adams referred to, roughly December 22nd, 2004, 5, I think, was the first point at which the law firm knew or should have known that, okay, there's a judgment out there that Mr. Krause didn't tell us about. And that was when Mr. Krause gave them a copy of the motion for order granting charging order, I think was the name of the document.
But he continued to make transfers. The law firm continued to make transfers. So I think his theory is making those transfers, facilitating those transfers in the face of a known judgment is a tort.
Correct. And
you concede that it could be a tort?
No, I don't, because case law across the country in the federal system, bankruptcy system, and elsewhere that has discussed fraudulent transfer, they've determined that a fraudulent transfer is not a tort. That's part of the flaw of their underlying cause of action, is that if you look at conspiracy, if you look at aiding and abetting, if you look at concert of action, in Nevada, each of those common law causes of action has to be based upon an actionable tort. And we cited case law in support of that proposition. Well, case law across the country has said that a fraudulent transfer is not a tort. Therefore, if you don't have an underlying actionable tort, these common law causes of action just can't be asserted.
Yeah, Nevada law, though, like if you go all the way back to Hotel Riviera versus Short in those cases, it is perplexing on whether it really requires a tort. For conspiracy. I think the more recent cases tend towards requiring a tort, but we have this kind of improper purpose gloss on our conspiracy tort. Could you comment on that?
Could you clarify?
Like our case law, the seminal case, if you will, is Hotel Riviera versus Short, where there's a band leader and I don't remember the exact facts, but the language is quite broad and it doesn't say it's two people agreeing to commit a tort. It is two people agreeing to do an improper act. And I'm paraphrasing here. And I think his point is that Nevada law is capacious enough to encompass that. Well, because our conspiracy law is rooted in a broader doctrine. And I'm not saying it is, but I'm asking you to comment on it.
And I appreciate that. The case law that we cited, however, that specifically addresses the issue of conspiracy and what are the elements of conspiracy specifically indicate that it had to be premised upon an actionable tort. So,
Nevada case law?
Nevada case law, yes.
Wouldn't the Woods firm have to get some of the assets to make it a tort?
And that's an important clarification as well, because we're dealing with a really obscure area of applying a tort against a non-transferee party. In NRS 166.170, it refers to trusted advisors, which are attorneys or accountants that help the transfer occur but don't actually receive the property, I think is what you're referring to, Justice
yes.
Sherry. And that's why the beginning of my argument was going to go over the procedural history of this case simply because it got confusing as we went through the case. Judge Gonzalez dismissed the common law claims in the first place. They then reasserted them in a second amended complaint. There was another motion to dismiss filed, and it happened to be during the pendency of that second motion to dismiss that October 1st, 2009 passed, which is when the change to that law went into effect. And Cadle argued at the hearing on that motion that, hey, Judge, guess what? We have new law in the state. NRS 166.170 now allows a narrow set of circumstances under which trusted advisors can be sued.
Counsel, a point was raised that the law firm was sitting at a deposition when the individual said, I have no assets, and thereafter helped transfer. Should we be concerned?
Well,
especially when I add the other part, because we've been playing with this, well, we didn't receive any property. Well, they got paid for the service of doing something for that individual.
And Justice Douglas, you have to understand and you have to look at the transcript.
Explain it to me then.
Thank you. The they're taking the position that there were, in fact, transfers made from Bob Krause to one of his trusts after the law firm knew about the judgment and knew about Judge Vega's order in which Mr. Krause was specifically ordered not to transfer any more property. But the evidence at trial presented from both Mr. Woods and Mr. Krause was that these assets that were transferred after the knowledge were never owned by Bob Krause. It wasn't like he went and bought something, took it into personal possession, and said, okay, let's go ahead and put it here. Rather, the testimony indicated that funds from Quest West Capital Partnership, I think the name of the partnership was, funds from that entity were used to make the purchase, and the assets were then purchased in the name of the trust. And I believe that's one of the reasons why Judge Gonzalez ruled the way she did, was because of all this testimony that happened at trial indicating that after the knowledge occurred on the part of the firm, there weren't really any transfers that occurred from Bob Krause into his trust.
I guess one of the things,
because it's conflicting with paragraph 41 of the findings and facts and conclusions of law that were read earlier. Yeah, in fact, it states, even after Woods and Erickson and Krause had actual knowledge of the debtor's exam and document production orders, they continued to act in accordance with the estate plan to transfer assets to remote entities. So how do you reconcile that?
I understand that was one of her findings. But the only way I can reconcile it is perhaps the reason that she found against Mr. Krause but not against the law firm is because it was Mr. Krause who was promoting those transfers.
But then you walk yourself into a problem, because there's a challenge to her applying the wrong burden of proof, that she applied clear and convincing when she should have applied preponderance. So you're defending essentially on the basis that she found no malevolence on the part of Woods and Erickson.
Exactly.
But if she applied to them a clear and convincing evidence standard, and if your opponent is correct that it should have been preponderance, then we're left with perhaps the judge viewed the evidence according to the wrong evidentiary standard, and you have to go back and do this again. So could you answer Justice Perigari's question in light of that? Because to me, that's a weak point in your case.
Well, I feel it's a strong point, and it kind of goes back to the procedural history that I was going to start out with, where the claims were saved because of the change in NRS 166.170. That was very clear. In the spring of 2010, when Judge Gonzalez denied the second motion to dismiss, it was because of the earlier change to the statute, which Cayley Company relied upon very heavily in their arguments to keep their case alive. And so when it came time to, we got fast forward to day 8 of trial, and I argued a motion for directed verdict, and in response to that, Cadle stands up and says, Judge, we're not here because of NRS 166.170. Let's clear that up. We're only here because of the common law claims. Well, that left Judge Gonzalez, I believe, in a quandary, because the only source to which she could look for an evidentiary standard for causes of action against a non-transferee party in the context of a fraudulent conveyance is NRS 166.170, which clearly provides a clear and convincing evidence standard. So I think she applied the right standard. I think she was probably as confused as we were when they abandoned any claims under that statute, because the claims had been saved by reason of the statute. But I think she applied the only standard that she could under the circumstances, which is clear and convincing evidence.
If the argument becomes, in order to recognize this particular cause of action, there has to be an underlying tort, wouldn't it necessarily be the correct standard of preponderance of the evidence standard?
I don't think so, simply because, once again, the only source of law that the court that Judge Gonzalez could look to was that statute that they were waving in the air back in December of 2010.
But if the statute didn't apply and you had to look to common law, and common law only recognizes it if there's an underlying tort, does that put you in a different position?
I don't think it does. And let's be clear, our position is, and hopefully we made this clear in our answering brief, that this state has never recognized common law causes of action against non-transferee parties in fraudulent conveyance actions. It never has.
And that's the majority rule nationally.
Not only the majority rule, but if you look at the little handful of states who have recognized those common law claims, none of those states also recognize self-settled spendthrift trusts like Nevada does. And so if this court were to go that far to recognize those common law causes of action, it would really put Nevada out there as a true outlier where it's going to allow common law causes of action, but at the same time it's going to allow these asset protection trusts to be established within our state. So, in fact, even the handful of cases that have recognized those common law causes of action have backed down. It's becoming a bigger minority. For example, the state of Arizona has since clarified its minority position to indicate that those common law causes of action are only going to apply if it can be established in evidence that the remedies allowed under the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act are inadequate as a matter of law.
Counsel, on that point, assuming that the court agreed that fraudulent transfer remedies are not available to a non-transferee individual, the separate question then involves what remedies are available for a civil conspiracy or a civil aider and abettor claim in this context. So, returning to finding 41, to the extent that there were transfers made subsequent to the knowledge, would the transferred property be the measure of damages, or would the cost that was incurred to recover the transferred property be the measure of damages for a finding of civil conspiracy or aiding and abetting?
Justice Hardesty, that's a great question. I don't think I've thought that far into it, but my position would be that if the court, the district court, finds itself in that situation, I think that you still go back to the property itself as being the property, the proper measure of damage. And the court has to recognize that, and this was kind of a side issue throughout this case, Cattle Company was offered remedy after remedy after remedy between Judge Vega and Judge Johnson. They were handed remedies on a golden platter, and they never followed through. They were handed a charging order.
Well, that was my other question. Counsel began his argument with the observation that under this estate plan and these transfers, they couldn't recover these assets. As I understand it, your client said legally they could, and from what I can tell, these are simply estate planning documents which wouldn't have precluded fraudulent transfer remedies. What were the remedies that Cattle Company sought to recover these assets, and why would they be entitled to recovery if they could otherwise recover them from the transferees?
That's we're in agreement on that. The remedy from day one has always been you go get the property through charging orders, through motions with the court to unwind the transfers and bring it back in Mr. Krause's possession so that it can be taken. Mr. Woods testified that when Judge Johnson extended the underlying judgment to include Quest West, which was Mr. Krause's investment company that had interest in pretty much all of these other LLCs, Mr. Woods testified that effectively unwound the entire estate plan. And had Cattle Company simply gone to Judge Johnson and said, please give us that asset, it would have been done. and we wouldn't be here today. But they didn't do it and instead decided to file another lawsuit and sued the Woods Erickson firm. So there's a lot of little subtle issues in...
So the evidence in this record and at trial was that Cadel never recovered any of the transferred assets and never made any attempt to do so.
And I'm out of time. Is it okay if I answer this
yes.
question? Thank you. And Mr. Adams can correct me if I'm wrong, but my recollection of the evidence was that Cadel Company did, in fact, recover some of the assets when they finally followed through with Judge Johnson's order. They went into Mr. Krause's home and took things out of the home. And they auctioned them, they sold them. But our position was always, well, that remedy that you exercised on that day should have been exercised three or four other times, maybe a year or two before then, when there was still value in Mr. Krause's assets. Thank you.
Mr. Adams, I will give you 3 minutes here. Perhaps if you could answer one question from me, is under the NRS 166.170, Mr. Miles said that your client abandoned that potential remedy in the proceedings here before Judge Gonzalez. What's your position on that?
I believe he's correct. I believe we did abandon it. I believe our theory was that, pursuant to the order of the court, that a civil conspiracy can exist as a matter of law in the state of Nevada because the wording of the Supreme Court is unlawful objective as opposed to tort. So clearly a fraudulent transfer, I think, would fall under unlawful objective. And so our position was this is a common law tort. The standard or burden of proof, of course, would be a preponderance of the evidence, which is, of course, one of the other issues on appeal is did Judge Gonzalez use a standard or burden of proof that doesn't exist for torts like conspiracy and aiding and abetting.
Well, fraud, the burden of proof for fraud is clear and convincing.
An important distinction is that Woods Erickson didn't commit a fraudulent transfer. I mean, they conspired to assist someone else to do that. So the burden of proof for a fraudulent transfer would not be the same as a burden of proof for a tort such as conspiracy to commit a fraudulent transfer.
Okay, I think we understand your argument there.
But on that score, Mr. Adams, I asked the same question I posed to Mr. Miles, and that's what's the remedy, assuming that you proceed now on a separate civil conspiracy aiding and abetting claim. The remedy isn't the return of the property or the value of the property, is it? Isn't the remedy the cost that you incur in chasing down the property?
I think the remedy is the value of the property fraudulently transferred, wherein knowing assistance, the conspiratorial assistance of the law firm was utilized. I believe it's the value of the, let me put it this way. The damages are the amount of the judgment that was owed to the creditor. To the extent that the value of the transferred property exceeds the judgment, certainly that would not be part of the damages. The damages would be the amount of the judgment. That was uncollectible because of the acts, this conspiratorial acts of the law firm. And, one of the things I quickly wanted to respond to was that there is a finding, paragraph 30 of the findings of fact, that list what Mr. Krause's assets were that were not yet transferred. And
go ahead and finish your point.
It's over $1 million. And there were plenty of attempts to collect these assets. We did unwind some of them from the trust. But in the judgment debtor's exam, for example, regarding Quest West, Mr. Krause simply testified it has no assets. So it's rather difficult. They made it rather difficult to collect the judgment.
Okay. Well, thank you both for these excellent arguments and briefs. We appreciate that. And we will take the case under submission. We'll be in recess till 11.